And hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
This is the Six Gun Justice Podcast with Wordslingers Paul Bishop and Richard Brosh.
You're not going to use the story, Mr. Scott?
No, sir.
This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
Hello and welcome. I'm Paul Bishop.
And I'm Richard Prosh, and this is another exciting episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, celebrating the blazing action of the Western genre in books, movies, TV shows, and any other media featuring white hats, black hats, fast horses, and cowboys with six guns that never run out of bullets.
As you might have surmised from our lead-in, we are heading to Tombstone today to hang out with Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, and the movies that have turned a 30-second shootout into the most famous gunfight ever to come out of the Wild West.
It's a gunfight where myth, legend, and facts collide with no accounting for where the bodies fall.
But before we get to our feature, how are you, friend?
I'm good.
Are you and Gina still getting things done around the hacienda while sweating in the humidity?
Yeah, we have. It's mostly maintenance stuff that we regularly do every summer, but it always has to be done, and it's always hot and humid when we do it. How's life in the ocean breeze of California?
Awesome, dude. Life out here is just one long remake of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Okay, now you're scaring me.
Actually, we're doing well. My wife has been fighting cabin fever with this whole pandemic situation. So we've been taking new or different hiking trails every day in the mountains or at the beach. We've even gone to a couple of drive-in concerts at the fairgrounds where everybody sits in their cars listening to the performers via their car stereo and beeping their horns instead of applauding.
Okay, only in California.
Dude, it's not a place, it's a frame of mind. And before I get any more carried away, why don't you start us off with a review?
I think that's a good idea. A drive-in review.
Yes, a drive-in review. Go for it.
I recently wrapped up two from Merle Constantine, Killer's Corral, 1968, and Steel Jacket from 1972. First, a little background. Ohio native Merle Constantine came to the Westerns late in his career as a published writer. He first saw his work in print in 1929 and decided to become a pro a decade later in 1939 after graduating from Vanderbilt. He created a fortune-telling con artist gumshoe named The Dean for Dime Detective magazine, and another character named Luther McGavock, a Memphis-based PI for Black Mask. Writing for the crime pulps kept him busy, but he also wrote what he called historicals for Blue Book and The Country Gentleman. One of his Western short stories appeared on live TV in a 1953 production starring Fred MacMurray. And it was thereafter that his Western stories started to show up as paperback originals for the Ace Double series and others. And listen, a tip of the Stetson and a free Western paperback offer to the listener who can track down the title and Constantine connection on that 1953 live TV production. All I know about it for sure is that it happened shortly after McMurray's wife died, so he muffed a few lines during the production. More info than that has proved elusive to me, so if you can find it, send me the answer and I'll send you a paperback of our choice. Constantine's prose was nothing too out of the ordinary with these books, and the plots were not overly unique, but with both books I got hooked by the pacing and I was surprised by the characters. So for example, in Killer's Corral, which was one half of an Ace Double with The Long Wire by Barry McCord on the flip side, it's a revenge story about a former gunslinger who's gone straight and sets out to track down the killers of Rand Clark, the man who helped him when he was down. The guy's name is Rush Letterman, and he leaves his young family to re-enter the life he left behind. I settled in for what I thought would be a kind of a by-the-numbers vengeance trail manhunt, but spoiler alert, instead Letterman faces the killers much sooner than I imagined, turning the book on its ear and giving Constantine legroom to stretch into a tale that I didn't see coming. Turns out Rush Letterman is more interested in proving the honor of his friend Rand Clark than simple revenge. Letterman's a surprising character because Constantine writes the best amoral moral character I've come across in a while. not exactly an anti-hero, as we might think of the term, supersaturated as we are with that, but similar in that highly personal brand of justice he dishes out kind of way. So too, the protagonist in Steeljacket, Joey Fugate, is a young man with a tough background who falls for a golden-haired gal named Amy Dennis. Fugate knows the Oklahoma Indian Territory better than anybody, but that doesn't mean finding the Dennis family's stolen gold is going to be easy or safe. This one wasn't quite as exciting as the Ace Double entry. So when I return to Constantine, which I will presently, it'll be with Guns at Q Cross and Death Waits at Dakin Station, two Ace Doubles currently on my shelf. Which, Paul, I think is part of the joy of collecting paperbacks, especially with authors you've never read. You pull one down, you read a writer for the first or second time, and suddenly the entire shelf opens up to you.
Thanks, Rich. That's a great review. And I agree, because I have so many books on my shelves that I haven't read yet, but it's just a healthy feeling having them there.
It really is.
So instead of doing my own review for this episode, I want to thank you for sending me the collection of Latigo comic strips written and drawn by Stan Lind.
You're welcome. Isn't Stan Lind great?
I think so, but my wallet doesn't, because now I not only have to get the other two volumes of Latigo strips, but I also need the collections of his Ricochet strips.
They're definitely worth it.
Once I did some research and found out about them, I also hit the internet and snagged the four paperback original Latigo prose books written by the prolific and versatile Western scribe Dudley Dean McGaughey under his favorite pseudonym Dean Owen.
I haven't read those, but I've heard mixed reviews about them, so reader beware.
Yeah, I've heard the same, but at least the cover art is pretty cool. Still, I'm happy to have them on the bookshelf, and I'll give them a try.
So let me know what you think of them.
Will do.
Are we ready to get to our showdown with Tombstone and Wyatt Earp?
Sure, but let's start with our own virtual hero strut down the dusty streets of Tombstone.
Hero strut?
It's that point in an action movie where the odds are down and there is always this iconic scene of the heroes strutting side by side on their way to the big gun down and their meeting with destiny.
Now that you bring it up, I agree. It's a definite regular movie cliche. I've seen it again and again.
The Magnificent Seven, The Professionals, The Wild Bunch, and uncountable others.
If you think about it, even High Noon has a hero strut, although it's the lone hero strutting toward the group of bad guys who are strutting toward him.
Absolutely, and certainly a number of the Tombstone-related films we're going to talk about in this episode are not immune from using the hero strut scene.
The hero strut. You made that up, didn't you?
Maybe. It's not a crime. It's no different than all the stuff people have forever been making up about Wyatt Earp and the OK Corral.
That's for sure. You know, there's a fine line between an exaggeration and a lie, but we can argue those ethics later. Right now, let's head them up, move them out, and get them doggies pointed toward Tombstone and the OK Corral.
I know you like that sound effect, so I should do it more often. Tombstone is obviously a physical location, but the events that took place there in a dirt lot 90 feet northwest of the OK Corral have become installed in the American psyche through Hollywood's constant retelling of those events while placing profit over facts.
You heard it at the top of the show in the clip from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
Which is exactly what has happened to many Western heroes and historical events, from Custer and Little Bighorn to Davy Crockett and the Alamo, and particularly to Wyatt Earp and the events of that famous Tombstone shootout.
No other real-life Western icon has been portrayed from as many different perspectives as Wyatt Earp. Unblemished hero, dastardly villain, fame-seeking narcissist, or unassuming recluse wanting no part of his notoriety. Was he any of those, or all of those, or do the facts depend on who's looking to exploit him to suit their own agenda?
Mythic versions of Wyatt Earp have been constructed and torn down again and again. One has to wonder how long the Wyatt Earp statue in Dodge City will be allowed to stand once the whole woke generation finds out it's there.
You're right. I never thought of that. He's certainly a mass of contradictions. Maybe it's because of the many debates surrounding his life that Earp and his exploits have endured the way they have. Since the deadly events near the OK Corral, heated arguments have raged over his portrayal as a murderous killer or a fearless lawman who refused to back down from his duty. Which is it?
I don't think anybody is really sure at this point. But everything has a beginning, and the creation of Hollywood's mythic version of Wyatt Earp and the OK Corral begins with a book. Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, by Stuart Lake. In the early 1920s, Earp was in Hollywood, a place he never felt at home, never at ease with the difference between truth and the whispered stories of his invincibility and town-taming prowess that either preceded him or followed in his wake.
In 1925, Earp commented on the situation, stating, "Notoriety is the bane of my life. I detest it. Not one of the tales in recent years is correct. My experiences as an officer of the law are incidents of history, but the modern writer does not seem willing to let it go at that."
And he had a point. While Earp's exploits in Dodge City and Tombstone had garnered attention from any number of newspaper and magazine writers as early as 1919, Hollywood was slow to recognize their potential.
That might have torqued him off more than just a little bit. Wyatt wasn't used to being ignored. As much as he claimed to despise that notoriety, I think he hated being ignored even more.
I agree. He tried several times to get his friend William S. Hart, who was the biggest cowboy star in Hollywood at the time, to help tell his own version of the facts of his life as opposed to the hoopla of the newspaper and magazine reports.
And as big a star as he was, Hart knew no movie made in Hollywood was going to stick to the facts, when hoopla and melodrama would play much better on the screen, right? Rather than tell Earp outright that nobody cared about the facts, Hart fought a delaying action by explaining Earp would stand a better chance of getting a movie made of his life if he put the events into a book first.
That was a pretty good way of slowing things down, because knowing writing a book was not in his skill set, Wyatt had to turn to his friend John Flood, who had often handled much of Wyatt's correspondence. But letters are one thing and writing a full-blown narrative is another.
Flood did try. He took careful notes from Wyatt while trying to keep Sadie Marcus, Wyatt's companion since late 1882, from interfering with her own ideas on how the book should be written. Sadie, who would stay with Wyatt for 47 years until his passing, was insistent there be no mention of her own dubious past or of Mattie Blaylock, a prostitute who had been Wyatt's common-law wife for 3 years.
And because of his inexperienced writing skills, Flood's final manuscript was stilted, florid, and totally unfocused. Any pulp writer could probably have done a better job than Flood did. No publisher would touch the manuscript, and even William S. Hart wouldn't put himself on the line to champion the manuscript with the studios.
But like a movie hero riding to the rescue, Stuart Lake appeared on the scene with a deadly typewriter strapped to his thigh and an itch to use it.
Lake was a former newspaper journalist and the press agent for Theodore Roosevelt's election campaign in 1912. He credited Bat Masterson with urging him to seek out Wyatt and tell his story.
In 1928, Lake would start what would become his lifelong career as Wyatt's biographer. He had many long conversations with Wyatt before falling ill with the flu at the end of the year. By the time he recovered, Wyatt's health was deteriorating, leaving them little more time together.
After Wyatt died, Lake would face his biggest obstacle in writing the lawman's biography, Sadie Marcus, who realized with Wyatt gone, his biography would be her only chance for ongoing income.
Sadie interfered incessantly. She demanded repeated changes, insisting the book be a nice, clean story. She was determined the prose show her in the best possible light.
Sadie's interpretation of the facts further eroded what had already become something of a tall tale. Lake was already erring on the side of making Wyatt an upstanding beacon of justice, and Sadie's input knocked off any further rough edges.
However, none of this would matter to the life of the book. In 1929, Lake signed a contract with Houghton Mifflin in which he was to split any royalties 50-50 with Sadie. Lake continued to do rewrites right up to the moment the book went to press in October 1931 and went on sale to the public.
By this time, Lake was convinced the book, Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, was destined to be a spectacular flop. He felt he would be lucky to break even for all the time and headaches he endured finishing the manuscript.
But the timing of the book's release couldn't have been better. Lake's portrayal of Wyatt as a white knight who rode into town to restore law and order provided a crucial spark of hope to a nation weary of lawlessness and in despair for a solution.
The book quickly sold out of the initial printing of 7,000 copies. It became almost impossible after that point for Houghton Mifflin to keep up with the demand for more copies. And with each book printed, Lake's historical inaccuracies, including placing the climactic gunfight inside the OK Corral, and portraying Wyatt as the leading lawman in Dodge City, were driven deeper and deeper into the accepted truth.
When Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, found itself mentioned in the New York Times, the reviewer flatly stated that what cities like New York and Chicago needed was a few more Wyatt Earps.
By this point, the facts have been gunned down by the legend, because the legend was far more needed than the facts. The legend was also far more entertaining, and suddenly Hollywood, which thought itself done with Westerns at the time, was all agog with Wyatt Earp fever, and films and TV portrayals of Wyatt Earp kept coming and coming and coming.
In 1939, Frontier Marshal became the second film with the same name to be based on Lake's book. One of the reasons it became more notable than the first is its all-star cast, including Randolph Scott as Wyatt Earp, Cesar Romero as Doc Halliday, along with Nancy Kelly, John Carradine, Lon Chaney Jr., and Ward Bond.
Wait a minute, Cesar Romero as Doc Halliday? It should be Halliday, right?
Apparently fearing a lawsuit from Halliday's family, the filmmakers changed the vowel. This wasn't a groundless fear either. The year the movie came out, Sadie Marcus, claiming to be Josephine Sadie Earp and portraying herself as Wyatt's legal wife, sued 20th Century for $50,000 in an attempt to keep them from making the second Wyatt Earp Frontier Marshal. After giving Sadie a $5,000 settlement and agreeing to remove Wyatt's name from the title, 20th Century released the film as Frontier Marshal. Of course, the history depicted in the film with kidnappings and gold robberies is as dubious as Lake's book. I'll just say Frontier Marshal gives viewers exactly what they wanted in 1939. Wyatt Earp comes to Tombstone and is enticed to clean it up. In so doing, it practically defines a subgenre of Western that we haven't talked about a lot. The town-taming Western that gave us not just the legend of Wyatt Earp, but so many others down through the decades.
The next major Wyatt Earp film of any note was 1942's Tombstone, The Town Too Tough to Die, starring Richard Dix as Wyatt Earp, Kent Taylor as Doc Holliday, and Edgar Buchanan as a dastardly Curly Bill Brosius. The movie does nothing to restore the truth of the events it portrays, and very little to add any shine to the legend. In my opinion, the film is not only a mangy dog, it's only slightly better than something you might pick up on your shoe in a dog park.
Whoa, that's harsh.
I just calls him as I see him. When the best part of the film is Wallace Beery singing in a saloon, you got trouble with a capital T, and that stands for Tombstone, the movie too tough to watch. Earp has about as much command presence as a Cheeto. Doc Holliday has apparently never been sick a day in his life. And Curly Bill is about as mean as a wet nurse. I will cut the film some slack for its portrayal of the big shootout as no muss, no fuss, down and dirty, bang, bang, you're dead, full of confusion and fear disguised as courage, over in a few heartbeats. With Hollywood and history barely being kissing cousins, Tombstone, The Town Too Tough to Die tries its best to get the gunfight right, which is a scene in most Tombstone films where facts and fantasy get divorced and go their own separate ways.
And who gets custody of the kids?
Wait, I'm the one who's supposed to get the laughs, and in this case, there were very few.
You know, of all the movies and books we're visiting about today, for me, My Darling Clementine, 1946, is the most problematic. With another great cast, including Linda Darnell, Victor Mature, Walter Brennan, and Henry Fonda as Wyatt Earp, it was directed by none other than John Ford, and critics describe it with such words as lyrical, graceful, and deeply romantic.
So, why problematic?
I love Fonda, and I can more or less enjoy the experience that the film offers. But with that Earp name and the famous gunfight thrown in, once again, it's the history that bugs me, Paul, or rather the lack of history. As we've noted, there were two earlier movies, both named Frontier Marshal, based on the fictionalized biography by Stuart Lake. But Lake retold the story in the 1946 book My Darling Clementine, for which Ford acquired the film rights. Superficially, Clementine is a remake of 1939's Frontier Marshal, and again, it's the town-taming Western. And certainly, Clementine takes this concept to an almost mythic dimension. The iconic figure of Wyatt leaning back to relax on his porch comes to mind, and arguably nobody but Fonda could have pulled it off. As Earp, he reminds me, he is sort of Andy Griffith at his best in that 60s sitcom. You always knew Andy was an affable fella, but there was this underplayed sense of moral courage and ramrod straight virtue. That's what Fonda evokes here. Watching the film, you can see Ford bring to the table so many things the traditional Western would come to be known for. The movie's theme of duty before personal vengeance. The visuals shot in Monument Valley are gorgeous. Fonda's at the top of his game, and the film lays down some of the most iconic Western dialogue you'll find, such as, "There's a stage leaving in 30 minutes. Be on it." My Darling Clementine is director Sam Peckinpah's favorite Western. It's President Harry Truman's favorite movie. It scores 100% at Rotten Tomatoes, and Roger Ebert has included it in his list of the great movies. But here's the thing. Ford claims that when he was a prop boy in the early days of silent pictures, Earp would visit pals he knew from his Tombstone days on the sets. I used to give him a chair and a cup of coffee, and he told me about the fight at the OK Corral. So in My Darling Clementine, we did it exactly the way it had been. Of course, it's not at all how it was, and that's sort of my hang-up with the film. A big enough beef to keep me from seeing it as the greatest Western of all time, which many consider it to be. Clementine Carter, the Earp love interest from the title, seems to be a combination of Big Nose Kate and Josephine Earp. Unlike the movie characters, the Earps were never cowboys, drovers, or cattle owners, and personal details about the main characters were all changed for the screen. As something of a tonic to all the fictional devices used, I'm right now reading According to Kate by Six Gun Justice sponsor Chris Enns, which is exactly what the title says. The real Mary Catherine Warney Cummings writings about her history and her relationship with Doc Holliday and events at the OK Corral. So I'd recommend According to Kate to Western history buffs as sort of a corollary to today's episodes. Now, that tampering with history would continue as the legend of the gunfight at the OK Corral branched ever away from the true history of the OK Corral.
Which brings us to Gunfight at the OK Corral, released in 1957. With the collusion of director John Sturges, Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas as Wyatt and Doc, respectively, get the full, big-budget, glitzy Hollywood treatment. This was the second of seven films Lancaster and Douglas made together, and I've watched all of them because the chemistry these two guys have is electric. Lancaster infuses Wyatt with the unstable explosiveness which was Lancaster's stock in trade. Douglas's Doc is a veritably robust tubercular, very different from the frail sociopathic dentist of history. However, both are riveting to watch, and I'll admit to happily buying into their portrayals. However, the problem with this version of the story is, again, the final gunfight. Current accepted theory holds that the actual gunfight lasted a mere 30 seconds, resulting in three dead men after an exchange of 34 bullets. The gunfight at the OK Corral's cinematic version is as much a ballet of violence as the finale of The Wild Bunch. The scene took 4 days to film and produced an on-screen bloodbath lasting 5 minutes. I have to tell you, I'd even like to argue with the accepted length of 30 seconds, which was established by armchair historians who have never been in a gunfight. I can tell you from my own experiences that when bullets are flying, 30 seconds is longer than eternity. So 5 minutes really challenges my willing suspension of disbelief. But hey, it's a movie, and it's Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. So just go with it.
I also wanted to take a nerd moment here, Paul, to note that DeForest Kelly, Star Trek's Dr. McCoy, plays Morgan Earp in the film. Trek fans know this wouldn't be Kelly's last fight at the OK Corral, as he got to portray Dr. McCoy portraying Tom McLowery in the somewhat revisionist psychedelic third season Star Trek episode Spectre of the Gun in 1968.
And that title, Spectre of the Gun, probably comes from the 1967 film when Sturges basically remade Gunfight at the OK Corral as Hour of the Gun. Obviously, the Star Trek writers were trying to capitalize on the then-recent film's title.
You know, late in life, Sturges maintained that his 1957 Gunfight at the OK Corral was a production planned, scripted, designed, and cast by producer Hal B. Wallace, and he was merely hired to direct. So Sturges wasn't happy with the tone of the film or the story. As you mentioned, Paul, with a new wave of revisionist Western reality pictures, take note that's reality with air quotations around it, Sturges revisited the legendary showdown in 1967, this time kicking the picture off with the gunfight and dealing with the aftermath in a moody, melancholy piece called Hour of the Gun, with James Garner as Earp, Jason Robards as Holliday, and Robert Ryan as Clanton. The film was based on the nonfiction book Tombstone's Epitaph by Douglas D. Martin, with a screenplay by Edward Anhalt, and it actually approaches the historical event with a fact-based sensibility. For example, in Hour of the Gun, Ike Clanton is shown correctly to have survived the OK Corral shootout, whereas previous films had him killed in the gun battle. During the opening title and credit sequences for Hour of the Gun, the last on-screen title card states, This picture is based on fact. This is the way it happened. However, the movie gets mixed reviews to this day, with Anhalt's spare script mostly to blame. I'm a big fan of James Garner, and his portrayal of Earp is pretty much universally praised, though again, it's suggested he was hemmed in by that script. I also enjoyed watching him play a more extroverted character in his second outing as Wyatt Earp in Blake Edwards' Sunset from 1988, a comedy thriller based on the 1920s period during which Earp was a technical advisor for silent films. While arguably Sunset is not a better movie, I think it's more fun to watch. Meanwhile, the 1960s were a booming time for a post-war crop of composers who cut their chops on Western film scores, and when Sturgis handpicked Jerry Goldsmith for Hour of the Gun, the composer brought along his acclaimed experience with the genre. 5 years earlier, having found success with the theme for Boris Karloff's TV show Thriller, Goldsmith had been introduced to the head of Universal's music department by composer Alfred Newman. Universal assigned Goldsmith to Lonely Are the Brave with Randolph Scott, a John Sturges movie, and the film's lyrical score won Goldsmith widespread recognition. Before long, he'd written music for another Western, Rio Conchos, in 1964. Beginning with a rousing flourish of trumpets, immediately followed by a volley of French horns, reminiscent of Elmer Bernstein's Magnificent Seven score, the theme from Hour of the Gun settles into a sweeping ebb and flow of strings and brass. There's the hint of wide open vistas and galloping horses, but I also detect an undercurrent of darkness in the bridge. I wrote more about it at the Western Fictioneers blog site back in March, and we'll provide a link in the show notes so that you can listen to it yourself. As one more nerdish tidbit, Fawcett Gold Medal had a novelization of Hour of the Gun by Robert Krepps, who had also wrote the Gold Medal tie-in for Stagecoach. Krepps wrote a lot of novelization for films, including The Big Gamble and Boys Night Out, so apparently he was a natural choice.
I was actually lucky enough to get a copy of the Hour of the Gun novelization from one of our buddies over at the Men's Adventure Facebook group.
Cool. Let me know how it is.
I will. And I'll let you know how the next film is, because possibly the least well-known of the major films to deal with the events in Tombstone is 1971's Doc, starring Stacy Keach in the title role and Faye Dunaway as Doc's paramour, Kate Elder, and also starring Harris Yulin as Wyatt Earp. Allegedly, Yulin appeared in over 100 films and television series episodes, but I still have no idea who the heck he is or how the heck he ended up in this film. Still, he acquits himself well, as does Keach. Both men underplay their roles while projecting a deadly, smoldering willingness to do violence that's missing from so many other actors who have played the roles. Directed by Frank Perry from an original screenplay by respected novelist Pete Hamill, the film is obviously told from Doc's point of view, with some good moments amidst the bad. The film's sensibilities are a totally 70s revisionist take on the story, tearing away at any shreds of decency the real-life characters may or may not have possessed. That said, the preparations for the shootout at the OK Corral are properly cold-blooded, and the gunfight itself is appropriately sudden, brief, and terrible. Should you see this film? I'd say yes, as the performances are strong, Hamill's script is surprisingly erudite, and Perry's direction tight and controlled. Hardly my favorite film on the subject, but it does deserve to be better known.
Clearly, 1993's Tombstone has developed a cult following with Western enthusiasts. From the repetition of Doc Holliday's catchphrase, "I'm your Huckleberry."
I'm your Huckleberry.
to that famous hero strut you talked about, Paul. The movie hit at just the right time in the careers of its stars, Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer, and maybe just the right time in movie history as well. It certainly was a financial and critical success, and entire books have been written about it, notably The Making of Tombstone by John Farkas. The history in the film is ruffled, but not as overtly pummeled as in earlier films, and I remember when I first saw it really appreciating the appearance of the Clantons, Johnny Ringo, William Brocius, and the McLowery brothers. Originally, the movie was to be Kevin Jarry's first job as director, but he was quickly overwhelmed, failing to get the needed shots and falling behind the shooting schedule. A month into filming, he was fired by producer Andrew Vajna and replaced with George P. Cosmatos, an action director known for working with Sylvester Stallone in Rambo, First Blood Part II, and Cobra.
Like, the guy who directed Cobra would be the obvious choice.
Right? Cosmatos brought a hard-edged work ethic to the production, apparently, that didn't sit well with the rest of the cast and crew, And it's often acknowledged that Kurt Russell, a veteran of Hollywood features at that point, helped revise much of the shooting script. Russell has actually claimed credit for directing the movie, saying that Cosmatos was brought in as a ghost director. Val Kilmer has more or less supported that claim as well, Paul.
That's funny, because when I arm-twisted Justin Marriott into creating the Western fanzine Hot Lead, he did all the work, while my contribution was strictly advisory. Justin wanted to credit my input, but instead of calling me an advisor or even advisory editor, he surprised me with the title of ghost editor, which I thought was pretty cool. I also thought I was the original and only ghost editor, but clearly not.
You did a good job as ghost editor. I must say, that's a great issue of Hot Lead. Ghost director or not, it was Cosmatos who worked tirelessly on accurate historical details, including the costumes, props, customs, and scenery. All the mustaches in the movies were real. And, you know, I've heard it said that if facial hair were a category, Tombstone would win the Academy Award for that. Val Kilmer practiced for a long time on his quick draw speed, and he was allowed to give his character a Southern aristocratic accent. I think it's these lush historical visuals and details that push Tombstone into my list of favorite Western movies, Paul.
It's certainly the most fun of all the Tombstone films, and certainly the most flashy and colorful. I really enjoy that film, and I can see why it's been such a big hit with people. Especially when you can compare it to the film we're finally coming to, which is Kevin Costner's Wyatt Earp, released a year after Tombstone in 1994. Unfortunately, it suffers from the close comparison. While this version makes a great effort to get the facts right, I still think Costner thought he was remaking Dances with Wolves, only set in Tombstone. Dennis Quaid is brilliant as Doc, and Gene Hackman as Wyatt Stab brings a unique twist to the story. And for his part, Costner is earnest and acting his heart out. But for all that, the film is 3 hours and 11 minutes long, and it meanders around so much trying to look pretty with big expensive scenes filled with herds of buffalo or railroad construction, it feels like double the length when watching it. I just wanted something to happen before I climbed into the screen myself and started shooting.
So other than that, how did you like the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
Well, if it wasn't for the killer ending. Well, thank goodness, partner. There's the clanging of the chuck wagon triangle telling us to wrap up this episode and get on with our shootouts and shoutouts.
Thanks to Mike Bray and Wolfpack Publishing for being our premier sponsor. Thanks also to sponsors author Chris Enns and the Western Writers of America.
Thanks to Roundup Magazine for their support in getting the word out about the Six Gun Justice podcast.
Thanks, too, to our crew of Patreon backers for their financial support. If you're enjoying the podcast, please check out the Six Gun Justice Patreon page and consider giving a monthly stipend to help us keep moseying along.
There is also a one-time donation button on the Six Gun Justice website. If you can afford to drop a carrot or an apple in the feed bag, rest assured it goes directly toward upgraded sound equipment along with recording and hosting fees.
Donations are always appreciated, but clearly not expected or necessary. We're grateful for all of our listeners and truly happy to have you sharing this trail ride with us.
Next Monday, Rich will be hosting another Six Gun Justice Speed Listen.
And in 2 weeks, Paul and I will be back with episode 14 of the Six Gun Justice Podcast.
Until we meet again, be kind to each other, be kind to yourself, and keep your eyes peeled for rattlers. Adios.
We're out of here. Let's ride.
Join us in 2 weeks for another full-length episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, sponsored by author Chris Enns, the Western Writers of America, and Wolfpack Publishing, publishers of such best-selling Western series as The Legend of the Black Rose and Concho.